Pour yourself a cold one.
Let's drink them, huh?
And listen to Russ Tucker and Philadelphia Eagles film junkie Fran Duffy break down the top college prospects on another tasty edition of The College Draft.
Yeah, it is daddy soda time after a week off because of travel for really all of us, I guess. Bri, me, Fran, we are back, and I have been looking forward to this edition of the College Draft Podcast for a long time. We are going to be looking back at the 2013 NFL Draft. They always say, oh, you got to give it at least 4 years before you can really judge it. But then nobody ever judges it. Nobody ever really goes back and sees how the teams did, as well as what happened in the first round. And really, I think, Fran, we got this from an email from a listener last year. It was really his idea for us to go through it in this way, correct?
Yeah, it was a listener, Ian Scotland, who gave us the idea. So we went back last year and we did the 2012 draft, and that was a blast because that first round was full of talent. The whole draft was full of a lot of talent. Not the case going back and looking at the 2013 draft is what we're doing today. It was really interesting, though, going back and just looking at those results and looking at my notes on players that I liked and some that I didn't like and how they panned out.
It's remarkable. And really, I don't know that there's any rhyme or reason why like a 2012 draft can be so good and a 2013 draft can be so bad. I mean, no one knew that or really was saying that going into the draft, were they?
You know, it was talked about a little bit, but you still had players that you liked. But I don't think that, I mean, because this was the draft, remember now, that, you know, you had three offensive tackles go in the top five. You had two guards go in the top 10. You know, there was only one quarterback that went in the first round. So it was one of those drafts where a lot of people weren't overly excited because there weren't a lot of sexy skill players. Not a lot of sexy defenders that were in there. Remember, Ezekiel Ansah went in the top five. He only played 1 year of college football. Like, there was just so much that there was so much projection with a lot of the skill players. And so then a lot of these other players got bumped up the board. But it was kind of unprecedented, man. I mean, you go back and you look, only four of the top 12 picks even made it to a second contract with their original team. And two of those four, Eric Fisher and Tavon Austin, I would say most people would say haven't lived up to their pre-draft slot. So two picks in the top 12 living up to what their original teams wanted, it's pretty remarkable how bad that draft turned out looking back on it 4 years later.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I should introduce Fran. Most of you that are loyal listeners, you know he's Fran Duffy from the Philadelphia Eagles. You can check him out at FDuffy3, a rising star in the scouting industry, in my mind, the draft prognosticator industry, which is not really what he does. He really actually evaluates players. I'm Ross Tucker. You can check me out on Twitter if you'd like, at Ross Tucker NFL. The show is the College Draft Podcast, and I don't know if there are any, certainly not many shows like it, in which every week, pretty much every week, we are all over draft-related topics, and we'll be evaluating players for the upcoming season, the upcoming draft, before you know it, because college football is right around the corner, about 2 months away. I guess let's start with this, Fran. When you look back on a draft from a team perspective, how do you determine or judge success?
You know, I think honestly the best way to do it to me is just seeing how many starters a team comes away with. You know, if you have a draft where you come away with three starters, I mean, that's a great draft. Like, you can't really ask for much more than that. But that being said, if you also come away from the draft with a blue chip, I mean, franchise altering player, and then the rest of the draft is, you know, the dreck, you know, that's not the worst thing in the world either. You know, I think just for, you know, my Philadelphia Eagles, I go back to that 2002 draft where they drafted Lito Shepard, Sheldon Brown, Michael Lewis, Brian Westbrook, four, you know, key pieces that were all great players. I mean, that's a great draft. But then you go back to 1999, they draft Donovan McNabb. Everyone after McNabb, there's not much to speak of. But
you drafted Donovan McNabb. And so both of those drafts were successful, even though, you know, it's very different in terms of how many starters they were able to pluck. A lot of people will say, oh, well, you know, look at the numbers, look at how many times, how many guys signed second contracts. Did you get a value on day three? So there's lots of ways you can do it. To me, I tend to look at how many starters you came away with and what were the impact, what was the quality of impact from those starters.
Well, let's dive into it. We'll start with the first round and then get into some teams that did particularly well in the draft and maybe some teams that did particularly poorly, and then also some individual picks. There's a bunch of different ways that you can support the podcast, one of which is Omaha Steaks going on right now. It's pretty much the best gift package I've ever heard of. It's essentially all of the meat, Fran, that you and your wife would need for the entire summer for grilling season for less than $50. It's an insane amount of food that you can get just by going to omahasteaks.com and putting Ross in the search bar to get this special deal. Let's start with the top 10. Chiefs took Eric Fisher number one. He is still there, and I would say he is a competent left tackle, but to your point, Fran, certainly has not lived up to the billing as number one overall pick. Then you've got Luke Jokel, number two, who was a disappointment in Jacksonville. I'm amazed that he got $8 million for 1 year from the Seahawks. There was obviously a market for his services. Then you have Deion Jordan, who he's also with the Seahawks. He has just not been able to get on the field for a variety of reasons. And then probably the two best picks of the top 10. The Eagles taking offensive tackle Lane Johnson at four, and the Lions taking Ziggy Ansah at five. It's funny, you know, sometimes I think, you know, draft and how we evaluate them and how good of a pick is, Fran, you know, part of it's like a sliding scale based upon, you know, who else went in that draft.
Yeah, and it's funny, both of those players, Lane Johnson had only played 1 year on the offensive line. Ziggy Ansah, I think he played, I said 1 year of college football, I think he played like 2 years of college football. Before he got to BYU, he didn't know how to put his pads on. So the fact that you saw those two guys go in the top five, and they ended up being the best players of the top five, you could even say top 10, I think it's just really interesting. It kind of speaks to what happened with this draft. I mean, you mentioned Deion Jordan's had all kinds of issues, both health-related and then also with suspensions. It's a really interesting case just looking at this entire class.
Yeah, you know what point I would make there, Fran, is I talk to parents all the time, and with the head concerns, the brain trauma, CTE concerns, the question I get a lot is, like, you know, when should I let my son start to play? And the only point I wanted to make as it relates to Lane Johnson, Ziggy Ansah, is it's not really a sport where you lose a lot by starting later. You know, like if you start sure. later in like wrestling or tennis or certain really sports where there's such skill, baseball maybe even, you're really going to be behind. Football is, lacrosse is another one. Football is such a height, weight, speed, athleticism sport that, you know, there's plenty of examples of guys, you know, Malik Hooker didn't play football
yep, exactly
until
right.
his junior year of high school because he was a basketball player. And right away, he was awesome. And right away, he started getting scholarship offers. Let's look at 6 through 10. Barkevious Mingo, Jonathan Cooper, Tavon Austin, D. Milner, Chance Warmack. What jumps out to me about those guys is that two guards went in the top 10, and their careers are still trying to be salvaged. Chance Warmack's in Philly with his former college O-line coach. Jonathan Cooper is with the Cowboys, but it's extremely rare for a guard to go in the top 10, any interior lineman. And frankly, Fran, the way those guys' careers have gone so far, that'll make it even more rare.
Yeah, and only one of those five guys actually re-signed with his the team that drafted him. That was Tavon Austin. He got a lot more money than a lot of people thought he would. We'll see how he does in the new offense being installed there out in L.A. But Chance Warmack, it'll be interesting too. You mentioned getting back in with Jeff Stoutland, his offensive line coach at Alabama, who's here in Philadelphia. And when you have, that's one of those things too that I think kind of gets lost in the whole process. And we talk about a lot of the off field and character and work ethic and how important those things are, but also with fit and where these guys end up. You know, I think that goes very much unsaid throughout this whole process. You know, I've talked with Chance Warmack a couple times about just Jeff Stoutland and why he feels that Stoutland can get the most out of him. And it's just the relationship between a player and coach. And obviously not having been in that kind of a relationship, especially at that high of a level, you could probably speak to that more, just the impact that a position coach, not necessarily a head coach or coordinator, but that a position coach can have on the success or lack thereof of a player coming out of college. I think that's another thing that kind of goes into this equation as well.
There's no question about it. And some guys are better with certain techniques than others. And if the offensive line coach wants them to do their technique, the guy might struggle if that's not what he's used to and not what he's had success with. Looking at 11 through 15, it's DJ Fluker in San Diego. Oakland at number 12 took DJ Hayden. The Jets took Sheldon Richardson at 13. The Carolina Panthers took Star Lotulelei at 14. And the Saints took Kenny Vaccaro, the safety out of Texas, at 15. I guess I would say that the best pick out of that group is probably, all things considered, Lotulelei. Obviously, Richardson has tremendous ability, but he's had a myriad of issues himself.
Yeah, you know, Vaccaro started off hot his rookie year. I think a lot of people had very high hopes for him, but he's kind of fallen off. But even Lotulelei, man, I mean, they re-signed. They gave a ton of money to K.K. Short, who was a third-round pick in that same draft. And they drafted a defensive tackle in the first round last year in 2016. And it wouldn't shock me at all if Lotulelei may be on the way out there, because I don't think he is signed long-term. His contract, I think he's going into his last year this year. So that will be very interesting to watch. You mentioned Richardson has had a ton of talent, or, you know, has shown a ton of talent, but just has not lived up to it consistently throughout his career in New York.
Let's get to then the next five, which is interesting. It's the Bills took EJ Manuel at 16. He was the only quarterback to go in the first round. The Steelers took Jarvis Jones at 17. The Niners took Eric Reed at 18. And then you had a couple of guys that have become very solid players at offensive guard position. The Giants taking Justin Pugh at 19, and the Bears taking Kyle Long at 20. You know, here we are, and wait till you see some of the next picks after that. Tyler Eifert, Desmond Trufant. I mean, here we are, Fran, where, you know, some of the best picks in the draft are 18 and below. It's really amazing. You know, we get so caught up in the top five, top 10, but a lot of times you'll see midway, later in the first round, that's where some of the best players are. You know, if the Steelers are rarely wrong on these edge guys, so you know it's a bad draft when they were wrong on an edge guy.
And it's interesting that draft with Pittsburgh, they drafted a few guys that were way, way down in terms of the athletic threshold and the people that really care about athletic testing. Guys like Jarvis Jones were way down in the list in terms of athletic testing at their position. And they, it seems, have made a concerted effort to go the other way. And in the last couple drafts, I know last year, 2016 in particular, they drafted a lot of players that would be considered athletic freaks at their respective positions. You go to a guy like Stephon Tuitt, you go to a guy like Ryan Shazier, you go to a guy like Sean Jones, the safety corner out of Maryland last year. I mean, they've drafted a lot of players going the opposite way. So I wonder if that 2013 draft was a bit of a learning experience for Pittsburgh, and they're trying to get away from some of the issues that class faced out there with the Steelers. And you mentioned both of those guards. I mean, Pugh started his career at tackle and struggled. So sliding inside has been really, really good for him when he's been on the field. And Kyle Long has turned into a really nice player. Interesting that the two guards that went 19 and 20 have had better careers than the ones that went at 7 and 10.
It really is. Then you get to the next five, Fran. At 21, the Bengals took Tyler Eifert. At 22, the Falcons took Desmond Trufant. 23, the Vikings took Sharif Floyd. 24, the Colts took Bjorn Werner. the edge player out of Florida State. And at 25, the Vikings took Xavier Rhodes. Rhodes has been excellent. Floyd has some type of medical health condition that is concerning. Werner, I don't even think he's in the league anymore.
No.
And Eifert and Trufant have both become excellent players. Eifert has just had some durability issues. Trufant has, you know, become one of the best players from this draft.
Yeah, absolutely. And then when you look at Eifert, if it weren't for the injuries with him, I mean, he would be one of the most consistent producers at the tight end position in the entire NFL. You mentioned Trufant and Rhodes, two of the best young corners. And so whenever you can get those kind of guys, look, you mentioned it earlier, all these this talent outside the top 15. That's why a lot of people, honestly, Ross, they look at that area of like, you know, the 16, 17, 18 through the mid second round as kind of the sweet spot in most drafts, because, you know, a lot of times you'll see some talent pushed into the top 15, maybe that don't deserve, you know, in a vacuum to be top 10 picks, top 15 picks. But there's always going to be good players that are worthy of that area of, you know, 15, we'll say to 50. And that's why you often see that that will be a huge sweet spot. I thought that was the case, especially this year as well. In the 2017 draft, you saw such good, talented players getting taken from mid-round one to mid to late round two.
As we keep moving along, we'll get to the next five. 26, the Packers took Dayton Jones, the D lineman at UCLA. 27, the Houston Texans took DeAndre Hopkins. That's obviously been a slam dunk. Maybe I'm slam drunk by saying slam drunk. 28, the Broncos took D lineman Sylvester Williams. 29, the Vikings took Cordero Patterson. And 30, the St. Louis Rams took Alec Ogletree. Obviously, I guess the one that stand out positively there, Fran, would be DeAndre Hopkins in Houston and Ogletree with the Rams.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, Dayton Jones was moved around a lot. They weren't sure what position they wanted to play him up in Green Bay, if he was a tackle, if he was an end, if he was an outside linebacker. He did that at times in their 3-4. Sly Williams has turned into a nice player inside for Denver. Cordarrelle Patterson is gone from Minnesota, but Hopkins has turned into an excellent player, obviously, down there in Houston, and one of the best young receivers in the league. And Ogletree has really come into his own. There were a lot of questions with Ogletree in terms of his ability to key and diagnose and see things quickly up front. Physical freak. I mean, just his explosiveness, his ability to play sideline to sideline, how physical he was downhill. I loved watching Ogletree on tape when he was at Georgia. But now seeing how he's developed has been really good to see as well.
The last two picks of the first round could not be more different, Fran. The Cowboys took at number 31 Travis Frederick, the center out of Wisconsin, and they were heavily, heavily criticized for doing so. The Ravens took Matt Elam, the safety out of Florida, at 32, and he's no longer in the NFL.
Yeah, and I remember everyone really kind of mocked Dallas for that selection of taking the center, because no one really talked about Travis Frederick in the first round, and he's proved everybody wrong and has turned into an excellent player. Looking at the top 32, I mean, you could probably make the argument that maybe 11, we'll say 11 or 10 or 11 of these players actually worked out in terms of how teams had imagined they would when they drafted them, which is, you know, you're talking about less than a third or just about a third of the first round actually working out, and two thirds of it not even coming close to the pre-draft expectations for those teams.
Speaking of teams, I'll tell you what's interesting is looking at some of the teams that had the best drafts. In your opinion, Fran, the three teams that you thought had the best drafts, the Detroit Lions, the Baltimore Ravens, and the Dallas Cowboys. I guess what really stands out to me about that is that the Ravens totally swung and missed on their first two picks, Matt Elam and Arthur Brown, which is very un-Raven-like. Yet you look at some of their other picks, Brandon Williams in the third, John Simon in the fourth, you know, Kyle Juszczyk in the fourth. Ricky Wagner in the fifth, Capron Lewis Moore in the sixth. I mean, this is why I think that the Ravens are so big on the compensatory pick formula and trying to get those additional third, fourth, fifth round picks, is because they feel like they can find players. And the 2013 draft is a pretty good example when you consider them whiffing at the top of the draft, but then nailing the middle of the draft.
And then, ironically, they'll probably get some compensatory picks next year for losing Ricky Wagner and Kyle Juszczyk in free agency to pretty big contracts this offseason. That's kind of what I thought. Honestly, Ross, it was really tough for me to kind of narrow it down to three teams that I thought did really, really well. So the fact that I went with the Ravens, even though they struck out with Matt Elam, the safety from Florida that I was not a big fan of coming out, and Arthur Brown, who I, on the other side of the coin, I loved coming out of Kansas State, and neither of those picks panned out. So the fact that I picked them to be in the top three, I think says a lot about this class and just the struggles that a lot of people had. But you look at Detroit, I mean, they nailed the Ziggy Ansah pick. You had Darius Slay in the second round. You had Larry Warford, who's turned into a nice player for them at guard in the third round. Devin Taylor started a lot of games for them at defensive end in the fourth. And then Theo Riddick, who's been such a dynamic option out for them out of the backfield. I know his numbers, for those that play fantasy, aren't always great. He can be a nice flex player for people that play in the fantasy world. But when you have to game plan for a Theo Riddick on a week-to-week basis, it's very, very tough to account for him because of how big of a matchup problem he can be in the passing game. So the Lions really, really nailed this draft in terms of the players they were able to pick from top to bottom.
In terms of the teams that struggled in the draft, the three teams that are most notable, you've got Cleveland, Indianapolis, and Minnesota. Obviously, they've all had issues with their first round picks, but even after that, there were some struggles from some of these other teams. It says something to me, though, that you have Minnesota there, even though they got Xavier Rhodes out of it.
Well, I think the reason why I put Minnesota in there was that they had three first round picks and only hit on one, and so just the fact that they had three shots at the apple cart in the first 32 picks, and they came away with Xavier Rhodes, who was a extremely talented player, but you know, Sharif Floyd and Cordarrelle Patterson just haven't worked out. They drafted Gerald Hodges in the fourth round, and he's turned into a nice player, but he's not on the Vikings anymore. He was in San Francisco last year, and really after that, not much to be said about that Minnesota class. So just the fact that they had the opportunity to strike so hard, and they just were, you know, it's kind of a swing and a miss for the Vikings standpoint. And in Indianapolis, they took probably two of my least favorite players from that class. When I did my pre-draft study, I was not a big Khalid Holmes fan coming out of USC. A lot of people thought he was maybe the best center in that class, and I just did not see it at all. So they took him in the fourth round to be a starter in front of Andrew Luck, and then they took Bjorn Werner, who I just did not see the talent there whatsoever to be a guy that be worthy of a first or even a second round selection in that class. And he went in the top 25 of the draft, and I just did not see it all.
How about the six biggest steals in the draft going back out of the first round, Fran? You think about the Steelers getting Le'Veon Bell in the second round, number 48 overall. The Redskins got Jordan Reed in the third round, number 85. The Packers, you went with an Ivy League guy, J.C. Treader, the center out of Cornell, who's in Cleveland now. In the fifth round, we've already talked about Ricky Wagner for the Ravens. The sixth round, Latavius Murray to the Raiders. And the seventh round, Damian Stafford with the Titans. Just one guy in each round that you felt like, obviously, those teams really did well. I want to get more, though, into what you thought, Fran. Because I think that's probably the most interesting, is we go back to your notes and what you said. You've already talked about Bjorn Werner. You were not on Team Werner going into that draft. Some of the other guys that you feel like you nailed were Matt Elam in Baltimore, John Bostic in Chicago in the second round, Christian Michael in the second round in Seattle, and with the Kansas City Chiefs in the third round, Travis Kelce.
Yeah, it's interesting. I was just looking through the draft, and I said, you know what? it would be interesting to see who are the players that the evaluations that I feel like I felt really strongly about. Maybe I was against the grain a little bit and I got right. Werner definitely was there. Matt Elam certainly was in that selection. Jonathan Bostic, I thought Jonathan Bostic was a late round undrafted free agent type, and he went top 50, and I was blown away that he got drafted that high. His physical traits were outstanding, but I just thought that he did not. We talked about that with Ogletree earlier, even to a greater extent. I didn't think that John Bostic saw things quickly enough to be an NFL starter, and he did not stick. Christian Michael, I did not see it with, even though he tested extremely well, and I loved Travis Kelce coming out of Cincinnati, and he obviously has turned into one of the best players at his position in the NFL.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. Now, what about the opposite, Fran? This is what I like about you. You are not afraid to say, hey, when I'm, you're like the dude in Dirty Dancing. When you're wrong, you say you're wrong. And five guys that you missed on, including Chance Warmack and Justin Hunter, the Titans just copied off of your thoughts and it didn't go real well. The Ravens with Arthur Brown, the Jags with Jonathan Cyprian, the Patriots with Aaron Dobson, and the Chargers with Keenan Allen. You weren't feeling Keenan Allen, huh?
No, I didn't see the kind of athlete in Keenan Allen that I thought would translate to NFL success at a high level. Like, I thought he was a nice player, but some people thought he was like the best receiver in the draft, I would say, in the media. And I didn't see that at all. And so the fact he went in the third round, he's turned into a nice player when he's healthy for the Chargers. But you know, looking back, like I'm sure, like if we had done this podcast back in 2013, I would have named the Titans as probably one of the big winners because I really liked Chance Warmack and thought he was a shoe-in to be a quality starter at the guard spot. And I was all in on Justin Hunter, man. I mean, I remember the first time I watched him at Tennessee. You see a guy who's like 6'4", 220 pounds, who ran like, you know, high 4.3s, low 4.4s, him going up and jumping over people. He was a track guy in college or in high school. It was just, his physical traits were just so, so outstanding. And so I was a big, big Justin Hunter fan. Fell for that one, hook, line, and sinker. Arthur Brown, I mentioned earlier, I was a big fan of. Jonathan Cyprian, maybe the one that strikes closest to my heart, because I remember watching Cyprian probably like late December, early January, and just falling in love with his play style. From FIU, and he was a huge hitter. He made plays sideline to sideline. He could play center field. He could play down in the box, and he just did not turn into the kind of player I expected him when he got picked in the 33rd overall selection by Jacksonville. Aaron Dobson, I really liked as well, coming out of Marshall, jump ball guy, made a ton of contested catches, just couldn't make the developments as a route runner that I thought that he would coming out from the Thundering Herd. But you know, all these guys, it's all learning experiences, man, and it's especially with a guy like Justin Hunter. You know, we talk about competitiveness, and you'll hear me talk about that throughout the year, you know, in just in terms of a guy's playing style and his demeanor. And the big knock on Justin Hunter seems to be, and from people I've talked to, is that he just didn't have that dog in him. He didn't have that ruthless, you know, intensity to become great. And if he did, he had all the traits in the world to become Randy Moss, to become AJ Green, to become a great receiver. But just his demeanor, and that's the case with a lot of guys, is, you know, they just may not have the mentality, not necessarily the nastiness and the toughness, but just the overall, maybe the work ethic and things like that, to really reach that upside. And that's some of the things that I learned throughout the way as I've gone through this whole process for the last few years.
All right, so let's get to some of your sleepers, Frank, because I always like that. You love talking about the guys late in the draft that you think have a shot. Three sleepers that I remember you were high on that hit in the fifth round: Chris Thompson, the running back for the Redskins. Sixth round, the Seahawks took Spencer Ware. He's become a nice player for the Chiefs. And in the seventh round, the Packers took Charles Johnson, the wide receiver, out of Grand Valley State.
Yeah, I loved Chris Thompson, man. And he went in the fifth round despite the fact that I want to say he had a fractured vertebrae his junior year at Florida State. I remember his game. I guess it would have been the 2011 season against Wake Forest. He just ripped them to shreds in the passing game, and you know how he was used on wheel routes and out of the backfield. He was moved into the slot. He did all kinds of different things for Florida State. And I just thought, you know, he could be Darren Sproles, and he hasn't reached that ceiling, but he has turned into a really nice complement in that Washington backfield. And Spencer Ware, I really liked coming out of LSU. He's turned into a nice player, not for the Seahawks who drafted him, but for the Kansas City Chiefs. And Charles Johnson, I remember watching Charles Johnson and thinking that this kid had NFL traits. He's turned into a solid player. If you're going to ask for what he's become in the seventh round, I think you're going to take that every time.
What about some sleepers that you liked that nothing never really happened for him?
I loved Zach Dysart, the quarterback out of Miami, Ohio. I know I wasn't alone with that one in the media. And Zach Dysart, to me, was a guy who had NFL size. He didn't have a cannon, but he had a good enough arm, showed the ability to work in the pocket and keep his eyes downfield and find receivers. I thought Zach Dysart had a lot of things that projected to a potential starter down the road, and he hasn't turned into that. I'm pretty sure he's still on the Denver Broncos roster as a backup, but I was expecting a little bit more from Zach Dysart. I remember watching Will Campbell as a defensive lineman with the Wolverines, and they drafted him in New York and made the conversion to offensive line, and that never really materialized. I was a fan of William Campbell and his potential because of his athletic ability. And then lastly, Zach Stacy from Vanderbilt. I like Zach Stacy. To me, I think of his running style a little bit like a Devontae Freeman coming out of Florida State a couple years later. Stacy had that early success with the Rams and then just kind of fell off a cliff. I think he ended up in New York and he's out of the league now. But Zach Stacy was another guy that I was a really big fan of coming out of Vanderbilt and just didn't pan out.
He had a nice rookie year. It just didn't really happen for him after that, interestingly enough. That'll do it for this week's College Draft Podcast. I loved it. Absolutely love going back over prior drafts. And Fran, to be able to get your hits, your misses, your sleepers, absolutely awesome. Next week, we will be joined by a special guest to break down a position in the game and talk about what traits we look for, what traits he looks for that translate best to the NFL. And we'll also get an early peek at a couple of players to keep an eye on at that position this season in college football. We're starting our positional previews. It's a great way, A, for you to hear about some of the top guys, and B, to learn what is really being evaluated when it comes to this position and these players. Please check us out on Twitter if you don't already. He is at FDuffy3. I'm at Ross Tucker NFL. If you always want to make sure you get all the latest with this podcast and others, go to at RTF Podcast. You can also always catch Fran on his Eagle Eye in the Sky podcast every week, talking about the game of football from the all 22 camera viewpoint. And of course, if you love Fran and just kind of like me a little bit, go ahead and download the SeatGeek app on your phone or buy some Saks underwear. It's by far the best ever. SaksUnderwear.com/Tucker. The keg is kicked. We are all tapped out.
Thanks for enjoying your Frosty One while listening to the College Draft.
Chug, 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 chug.
Make sure you're also subscribing to the Ross Tucker Football Podcast, Fantasy Feast, and Even Money Podcasts, all available on iTunes at RossTucker.com or wherever podcasts can be found.